Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Scott McNeely to the broadcast. Scott co-founded and served as Chief Executive Officer of Sun Microsystems from 1982 through 2006. The company was sold to Oracle in 2010. More recently, Scott co-founded and has served as CEO of Weigh-In, a social intelligence company that integrates social content into new experiences for consumers and delivers greater value and control for brands. Scott received his bachelor's degree in economics from Harvard University, and he received his MBA from Stanford University. I recently caught up with Scott by phone, and our conversation covered the future of the chief information officer role, how his work at Sun Microsystems influenced the emergence of cloud and social technologies, and his views on the future trends, including big data and the intersection of new and old industries, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much.
Scott, we'd begin with just sort of a bit about Weigh-In. In 2010, you founded the company, and it's a real-time digital marketing software company. I wonder if you could describe kind of the original inspiration for the idea. And I'm also curious, since it was founded relatively soon after Sun's acquisition by Oracle, was this something that had been playing around in your head for a while? Or was it something that you really began to think about in earnest upon breaking away from the company?
When I left Sun, I was just advising companies for free and getting very busy. I found out that free has infinite demand. So eventually I kind of said I'll advise for stock. And even then I have basically infinite demand because people would be happy to give away pre-IPO stock, you know, or what's called seed money stock for advice. So I'm still overbooked, but a buddy of mine from New York called and had this idea to, you know, we all understood that the network was the computer, but the database is the gold mine now. And so everybody's looking for ways to engage the consumer and do some things real time and on air and that sort of thing. So we came up with an app that was part what we're doing today around social, part Instagram, and part social network. And we started off by basically doing an Instagram on your mobile phone with voting attached. And if we'd just done pictures, we might have been able to beat Instagram. Who knows? But anyhow, Instagram won. Nobody wants to pay for voting. But this whole idea of engaging the customer to capture demographic, geographic, psychographic, attitudinal, you know, kind of information, as well as using social to influence, to persuade, engage, inspire, or reassure somebody at the moment of truth was all part of the plan from the beginning. But it was my buddy from New York who said, Scott Johnston, who said, let's go start a company. And I said, all right, well, I'm not going to go run it. I just got out of the pinata. And so he said, well, I can't. I've got a job, and I've got kids out here in the East Coast. And downstairs walked a buddy of mine who I'd known for 30 years, a Harvard MBA, who had just sold his gaming company to John Malone in Denver. And I said, TJ, guess what? You're our new CEO. Let's set it up in Denver. That's halfway in between. So we set it up, raised money, and got it going, and you know, basically evolved the campaign. And then about a year ago, the CEO, the second CEO who took over after TJ, TJ was more of a B2C guy, and we kind of evolved to a B2B company. So brought in a new CEO and voluntary exit on her part. We ended up nobody to run the joint. So the board looked at me and said, all right, Scott, you're it. And so I've been doing it for about a year. But that's sort of the evolution of the management and the evolution of the product. And in the last year, I've spent a whole bunch of time building the team, supporting the team, putting a really good planning process, I believe, in place, building out the plan for this year. Raised over $15 million to basically make us one of the best funded companies out there in this space. I think that's probably why, for instance, Livefyre had to go find a sugar daddy, and you see some other companies out there looking for sugar daddies, or to be totally appropriate, sugar mommies.
sugar people, maybe?
Yeah, sugar folks.
Yeah.
And the other thing I was able to do is create a really solid board for the organization, get us connected with a whole bunch of really solid customers out there. So it all felt like a good start, but I was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm going to be here forever. So we started a CEO search, but all of a sudden we ran into Engage Sciences and saw how complementary they were. It was kind of freaky complementary, in the sense that they had a CEO, we didn't. They had a CTO, we didn't. They had a senior product marketing guru, we didn't. We were strong in Asia and the U.S. and South America. They're strong in Australia, New Zealand, Middle East, and Europe. They did digital activation and engagement campaigns. We did social marketing, digital marketing campaigns, complementary there. The technologies were all built on very similar technologies from engineering and programming language and other APIs. We were both cloud-based, both using Amazon. We both are Salesforce users for the administrative piece. So we looked at this and we thought, this is spooky. And the more our team spent together, the more we said, hey, this just adds to our portfolio. The only bit of product overlap is that we're on our second generation of social marketing platform, and it's probably the best, and I'm pretty comfortable it's the best in the industry right now. And Engage Sciences had a little component of their platform that was a kind of a really first generation and quite immature social piece. So the real opportunity here was they could just stop doing that and just piggyback our platform. And our platform inserts our social campaign seamlessly right into their broader digital engagement platform. So the engineering integration is, a couple of seconds.
Very interesting. Like you said, it seems as though the complementary nature of the organizations almost made it seem like it was meant to be. Is the combined entity, where is it going to be based? In the UK, in Denver, somewhere else?
Richard Jones is moving to Denver.
Okay.
In the UK. Headquarters will be way in headquarters. And in this space, you want to be in the U.S. You want to have access to U.S. capital markets. You want to have access to the U.S. customer base. And you want to have access to the U.S. engineering. Although we have global reach in all of those areas, it's still nice to be local. And the nice thing about Denver, if you're trying to hire people in San Francisco now, good luck. Try and hang on to them. Try and find a house for them. Try and pay the taxes for them, all the rest of it. We got an incredibly lower cost of operation out in Denver and actually find a parking spot. And, you don't have the traffic jams and all the rest of it. The skiing is way better. And it's actually got a great airport that goes direct to every chief marketing officer in the country. So it's actually a very, very good spot to be in.
That's great. Yeah, I was going to ask you about Denver, and you've explained, I think, most of the reasons why that was attractive, and conversely, why Silicon Valley, which given your involvement, would seem to be the obvious place to locate the company, why that was less attractive. It's interesting. I mean, would you speculate that more companies are going to be looking for alternative places for the reasons you've described in terms of the disadvantages of the Bay Area?
Well, I would argue we're actually uniquely positioned. One co-founder's in New York, which is, obviously a big CMO haven. The CEO is international and located in Denver. And the chairman is here in the Silicon Valley. And so I can go over and see Dan Rose over at Facebook and Instagram or go play golf with him and know the Twitter folks, Adam Bain and all those guys up in the city, and I can be there in 30 minutes. And, you know, just having the technology access, Larry Sonsini, who's our general counsel, is here in the Bay Area. I mean, we got the best of all worlds that way, and we don't have to deal with. California's ranked 50th of all states in terms of business hospitality. And there was an article, you can research it in the Mercury News just this week, that said a third of all people in the Bay Area or California, I can't remember, are ready to leave. So it's a pretty mismanaged state.
You speculated, Scott, that over half a billion campaign entries on the combined platform between the two companies, Weigh-In and Engage Sciences, that you have about 1 in 14 of the world's population having already participated in a brand campaign run by the two entities. And then you speculate that that's going to be 1 in 7 next year. Can you explain the path to that kind of growth?
It's just, you know, the partnerships we have lined up, and that we have, you know, we're a heavy recurring model, and we know the campaigns we're going to be driving. We know the new customers. Just, for instance, with Major League Baseball, we signed them up, and you know, we're rolling out through all of their stadiums, all the rest of it, just the reach we get. I mean, it's all about, you know, I like I said, everything's a life support system for the database, and this marketing database that'll allow you to match ready and willing buyers with sellers. That's the holy grail out there right now. It's pretty easy to see that straight line going there.
Yeah, that's interesting. For organizations, CMOs or CEOs, CIOs, other executives with whom you're meeting with to impart wisdom about Weigh-In's offering, how sophisticated do you find the buyers are, and how has that evolved in recent years, especially among some of the larger companies?
Let me tell you, sir, if I were to start the Forbes story, and you can feel free to plagiarize, or maybe you won't want to do it because you didn't even think about it, but here's how I think about it.
Please.
I was a little boy. My dad was group vice president of North American marketing for American Motors, and they'd run a Gremlin ad or a Pacer ad or whatever, and they'd be really funny. And we'd laugh and chuckle, and you know, I'm 12, 13 years old, and I go, Dad, that was really funny, and we're all giggling and all the rest of it. And he'd go, yeah, in fact, we're getting great recall on that ad. I said, what's recall? He said, that's where people remember, you know, the name of the company. I said, well, that's cool, but did it sell any cars? And his answer was, that's a good question, son. We really don't know.
Right.
And you know, if you look, three-quarters of the ad budgets are still traditional print and media. Yet today, everybody worldwide, it's not just in the U.S. or other, everybody is spending more time in front of a digital screen than they are TV. My boys, I've never seen them pick up a magazine. Are you kidding me? So what we offer in the digital marketing space, and we think we have now the broadest and most sophisticated next generation digital marketing engagement and activation campaign platform, all SaaS-based, and every 3 weeks we give you a new version of it. It just, you log in and you got more good stuff, right? What this gives you is what I call provable as well as improvable campaigns. In other words, we can show you a real-time ROI dashboard on all of the key metrics. You can actually set your own values for what is a time on, what's a minute on site worth, what's a retweet worth, what's a click to buy worth, what's a whatever, and then you can keep your own customized dashboard. And then we can start doing A-B testing and see what works better, what social works better, should morning or night, what colors work better, what visuals work better, does the quiz work better than the sweepstakes? And we can do A-B testing on your ad dollars. Now contrast that to running two different ads on consecutive nights for a car. How do you know which one sold more Mustangs? Think about a billboard on the side of the road versus another billboard. Are you kidding me? You have no idea who viewed it. You have no idea whether it drove sales. You have no idea which one was better. And so going back to your question, when I talk to CEOs, I look at them and I say, really? You're going to spend $40 million launching this new product with TV and print, and you have no idea, no way of proving Whether and let me tell you, all the SAMI reports, I did all of that. I was in product marketing in the soft moist category at General Foods for Puppy Choice dog food. And let me tell you, we had no idea what anything was doing. I looked at this and I go, this is crazy. And we are still in the dark ages in marketing with 3/4 of the budget. And so what we're looking at is the arbitrage as people move from, you know, this random flare. It's a flare in the night kind of thing. And you have no idea what's going on down on the ground. And we're giving people that great individual digital marketing platform, pre-built, ready to go, custom visualizations, custom implementations where they want to. We add their colors, their logos, and we run the campaign. And then we hand them a spreadsheet and a massive database of the people who engage with their psychographic, demographic, geographic information, and away they go. I mean, literally, we send them a spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet with all the customer information on it. What TV ad does that? What billboard sends you a spreadsheet of everybody who saw it?
Exactly. That's really, really like playing with the dinosaurs in terms of the traditional way of thinking about things.
But the CMOs love going out to dinner with the ad agencies, love sitting in the conference room and shooting down 6 of 8 presentations, telling the other two to go back and get your acts together, and then picking one, and the guy with the purple mohawk wins. And, you know, it's like, huh? And then they go off and they create this. I mean, they're basically movie producers. They go off and they produce a 30 or 60 second movie, and then they launch it, and everybody stands around like I did when I was 12 with my dad. Hey, that was funny, or that was cute, or that made me cry, or whatever. Did it sell anything? I mean, I think the CEOs are stiff-armed from this conversation a lot by the CMOs, and they don't get involved. And I think one of the things I can do, and I'll probably aggravate a CMO or two in the process, you know, hey, you need to get involved and make sure it's provable and improvable, because we can do real-time tweaking of an ad campaign in real time. And, you know, A-B testing is not new, but advertising just isn't into that game yet.
How does Weigh-In drink its own champagne? Can you talk a little bit about how you've used, how the company has used the very insights you're describing to change the decisions it makes?
Our product is typically used for B2C customers, so, and we're a B2B company. There are people who use our product directly to businesses who are B2B companies, and that would be, for instance, an Oracle or an EMC or others who use it for events. But most of our customers are using our product to get at large volumes of consumers, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, even billions. So we are tending to sell to very large organizations, MLB, NHL, AT&T, B of A, those kinds of things. And then they sell to their very, very large customer groups.
Understood.
We still use our own product enormously every day, but our customer base is in the thousands, not in the millions.
Right. Understood. I'd love to talk to you a bit, Scott, about the sort of evolution of the internet that you in some ways are ideal to speak about. Obviously, you were the co-founder and former longtime CEO of Sun Microsystems. Steve Case actually recently wrote a book, I don't know if you've read The Third Wave, but where he talks about the three waves of the internet, the first wave from 85 to 99 of sort of building the internet, laying the foundation. Obviously, organizations like AOL, like Sun, like Cisco, among others, would typify that. The second wave from, as he puts it, 2000 to maybe 2015, the app economy, the mobile revolution, search, social, e-commerce startups. Think Google, Amazon, Facebook, Twitter, etc. And now he defines now this third wave involving the Internet of Everything, this ubiquitous connectivity that allows entrepreneurs to transform major real-world sectors. And a point he makes, and I'd love your thoughts, as well as maybe a little bit of your own perspective, as someone who's been a leader across each of these, what he would refer to as these waves, he posits that this wave is going to look a lot more like the first one than the second one. He highlights that the second required people, products, and platforms, but the first added to that the need for greater partnerships, a understanding of the nuances of policy and working with the government. And I'm curious about your own perspectives on that analysis, as well as your own sort of thoughts about the evolution of the internet as you've seen it.
We talked about all this stuff in the 80s and the 90s, the Internet of Things. I was on the cover of Fortune with a Java ring on, you know, back in the, I might have been in the 80s or early 90s. And we talked about, I always used to talk about price lists will go away and everything will be a bid ask. And I said, eventually people will bid out their time by the hour. And, you know, that'll be the last frontier unless government can regulate us into the dark ages again. And they're trying with Uber and they're trying with Airbnb. If it moves, tax it. If it moves some more, regulate the crap out of it. And, you know, that's what the bureaucrats and the crony status are all trying to get done out there in the marketplace right now. So the second our company saw the browser and the web and we threw Java on it, we started talking about the Internet of Things, everything with a digital, electrical, or biological heartbeat will get connected to the Internet. And people looked at me like, what are you talking about? And now people sort of, we said the network is the computer in the 80s. Now people call it cloud. That's smarter. It's only one word instead of a few. But, you know, all of these concepts were out there and no price list, a bid ask system. But, you know, the biggest challenge we have and is the meddling, pain in the butt, government bureaucrats getting paid off by big companies to prevent the new stuff from happening. Have you ever met anybody who got in an Uber and thought it needed to be regulated or that it needed to be? I'm talking a basic consumer, not somebody with a vested interest in a cab company in city revenues. It is the most stunning increase in, and even cabs now are getting better because Uber came along and is just destroying them. And so why do we need to regulate that stuff? My biggest concern for the future of the Internet and the written and spoken language of computing is government intervention. And there is so much massive government scope creep that they are getting involved in everything now, whether it be net neutrality and whether or not somebody is an employee or not. All of these things that they're, and then healthcare, and then we have ignorant voters because they're being trained by the government, and the government is a monopoly. We know monopolies are inefficient, not innovative, and corrupt. We know that. That's why we have antitrust laws. Well, the government is a monopoly. Why do we let them do health care and education or even get near banking? It's stunning to me, hypocrisy of government bureaucrats and the, you know, the absolute ignorance of the voter in voting these things. But, you know, that's going to be the big threat. So I wish Steve would write a book on that instead of trying to categorize something that was identified 20 years ago already.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm curious, how have you chosen, or why have you chosen to remain in California, since, as you point out, in some ways, this is kind of the worst example of the things that you've just described?
Well, so it's complicated. My wife is from Orinda. Her parents are here, and my mom is here. Four boys, you know, and I started the son 35, almost 40 years ago.
Right, of course.
35 years ago, out here in California when I came out to go to business school. I came out here for the weather and the golf course. And little did I know, I mean, this was the land of Reagan.
Right, exactly.
It wasn't known as the land of Jerry Brown. By the way, Jerry Brown is the one who put government sector unions into California, and then 40 years later, we bring them back in after the place is bankrupt. Go figure that. Yeah, it's the land of Pelosi and Brown, and, you know, it's just like, are you kidding me? It has changed. It has changed dramatically to where we have a supermajority, and Bernie's going to give Hillary a run here, you know? Go figure that. When I grew up, socialist, I mean, you couldn't insult anybody more than by calling them a socialist. You're not old enough to remember that, but it was all about personal responsibility. You work for a living, don't vote for a living, and so it's changed. So I'm kind of stuck. I have one boy at Stanford, and I have three boys in high school here in California, and to go uproot them all just because, you know, I don't particularly agree. It's hard to do.
Exactly. No, naturally. One's government principles and personal principles and business opportunity, obviously, it's a complex web that leads someone to be somewhere, I recognize. So I wanted to also ask you, you talked about your father, and I can only imagine he was an extraordinary influence on you as somebody who was a corporate leader before you were. Two questions I wanted to make sure I asked you. Number one, I'd love to understand other people who've been particularly influential in your career and why. And then I'd also like to, perhaps a related question, understand what you consume in order to remain abreast of change in technology. I mean, especially given your current business and other areas in which you are interested, the pace of change is just extraordinarily fast right now. And I wonder how you remain abreast of that, who you speak with. Obviously, you've got a platinum network, but what you read. And obviously, all of this is in the service of perhaps offering advice as to how others might do the same.
Well, it's a little unfair for me. First of all, I got four teenage boys. Well, one's 20 now, so there's one source. I've got a younger wife, so she's very technically savvy. She's the CIO for our house. she's a digital native, unlike I was, or I wasn't. But so that helps. I have that network. I do advising for 30 or 40 companies. You know, I'm not an employee or whatever, but I just say, give me a little stock option and I'll help you. And so they're bringing me in all the time and asking me for advice. And I'll do three breakfast meetings in a row at Bucks out here. Just meeting with people, talking to them, so that helps. I'm on a couple of very large technical advisory boards. I keep those confidential because they want to keep them confidential. But with major telecoms and other technology companies in a broad range of fields, and then with the internet, holy mackerel! Just following the right folks on Twitter can totally keep you abreast way faster than the old days when I used to wait once a week for Forbes and for Information Week and for InfoWorld to come out and see what's going on. So it just happens so fast now. There's no way you can keep totally up to speed. And where I have become a lot more informed is the intersection of technology and the CMO. Because in my day, it was mainly the technology and the CIO. For the manufacturing folks, and technology really took a while to get to the marketing sales arena, and now it's hitting big time.
What do you think about the future as somebody who has interacted with CIOs practically since the advent of the role? What do you think of its evolution, especially now? I mean, in some ways, what you've just described is the kind of the fear of the CIO, that somebody who is a technologist running a technology company is now seeking the CMO rather than the CIO. What do you think the future holds for the chief information officer role?
Well, see, the CIO used to be called the chief information officer, and they lost sight of that was their role. Instead, they decided, I want to become the chief infrastructure officer, and I want to be the chief integration officer. And the cloud now is the infrastructure. The integration is done by the cloud supplier and the app supplier. So their only role left is to become the chief information officer. And most of them don't understand how the information is used. I shouldn't say most. I said a lot of the traditional old school ones never really worried about how the information was used, what it meant to revenue, to profits, to productivity, to the bottom line, all the rest of it. When my oldest went to Stanford, he asked me, what should I major in, Dad? I said, become a big data scientist. Because that's what a CIO should be, is a big data scientist. And he said, there's no degree. I said, when I went to college, there was no computer science degree. And you're going to college, there are no big data science degrees. Let's make one. We'll take all. And so he chose management science and engineering. So he's taking business classes, statistics, math, computer science, economics, a little bit of psychology. And building all of that into a big data. And he loves it. And, he understands, and it's all about, in the old days, the network was the computer, and that's where you had telcos and Cisco and EMC and Sun and Oracle, all as the big horses. Now It's all about big data and algorithms and analytics and all of the rest of that stuff, the statistics being a big one. So that's where the CIO has to go. But so many of them are, you know, want to be computer designers or data center operators. And the CIO and the CMO who are trying to drive revenue, or the CFO is trying to cut costs, are all looking for answering the data.
That's, yeah, that's interesting. I like your analogy of the chief infrastructure integration officer as a contrast to actually, you know, working with and drawing inspiration and ideas and insights from the information itself. You brought up your son and your advising of him, whether it's him or other young people. Like, what's the equivalent of the graduate answer of going into plastics to, you know, today? I mean, data science obviously is a good category. Are there sort of other fields that you think are particularly ripe? Are there trends that other than social, obviously, and big data analytics that really excite you as you look out, say, 3 or 5 years?
I was talking to John Hennessy, the president of Stanford. I was in his office a few months back, and I said, so in one sentence, John, what's the mission of Stanford? And he said, it's to be at the intersection of technology and medicine. And I thought that was just brilliant. And I thought, holy mackerel, there's nothing more powerful than that. And so I think anybody who can study medicine, chemistry, biology, computer science, big data, all of that other stuff, you're going to be the most employable person in the world. I'm going to digress. I'm an old guy now. I'm over 60, so I get to rant. I was at a bar with my wife, and this guy came up. We started talking to him, and we were asking about his kids because we always like to hear what other people are doing and all the rest of it. And he said, well, you know, he's chasing his dreams. I'm proud of him. He's at least out, and he's chasing it. Well, what's he doing? Well, he's, you know, tending bar down in L.A. I go, well, he wants to be a bartender? No, he wants to be a screenwriter. And I said, you know, there's a lot of screenwriters down there. He goes, yeah, but, you know, I'm happy for him. He's chasing his dream. And, you know, he had a music, he studied music in school or something and then studied the classics. I don't know what he did. I can't remember. It was nothing that I could imagine hiring him for at Sun or at Wayne. And so all of a sudden, I just sort of lost it. I said, you know what really bothers me? Is that everybody is telling everybody to go chase their dreams. You know what I'm telling my four boys? I'm telling them, chase a job. Be a taxpayer. Support your family. Get off the government dole and don't chase your dreams. After you've gotten totally successful and financially independent, then go chase your dreams. But until then, chase a job. And it just drives me crazy that parents let their kids chase their dreams. So anyhow, that's my old fogey moment. So, you know, when you ask me what should kids chase, it's pretty easy. Go look and see who's hiring and then what jobs, and go get a degree in whatever they want. And there's lots of people who are looking for strong technical people, both in big data and in medical, in robotics, in sensors, in Internet of Things. I mean, there's just a million places out there where the demand is infinite for people who have a real sense of purpose and a sense of duty and a commitment to that, you know, and that means I'm sort of past hiring really great frat presidents.
Understood. Well, Scott, thank you so much. A great conversation across a variety of different topics.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.